This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
Welcome back to the Legarten Institute, David Abulafia. And when you were last here, you gave us a synoptic view of the Middle Ages and the role of the origins and development of the capitalist trader. But you're not allowed the grass to grow under your feet in the past 12 months, and your explorations have taken more than one oceanic trend and dimension. So you returned us to talk about the trader across the seas. Which particular seas?
Well, what I'm trying to do really is to go beyond the relatively narrow framework of what I did with the Mediterranean, which when you actually look at the globe, you discover, of course, it is really rather a small area of water compared to the oceans. And so there's always a question about the trade of the Mediterranean, whether in antiquity, the Middle Ages, or subsequently, which is that goods are being fed into the Mediterranean from much further afield. So one wants really to understand how, going right back in time to the Greeks and the Romans, how they acquired, for instance, the vast amounts of pepper. We know that the Romans had warehouses absolutely full to the brim of pepper in Ostia and in Rome itself, which was not just for the consumption of the imperial palace, the elite, it was obviously for regular consumption among citizens of the city of, I wouldn't say all social classes, but many social classes. So there's always that question about the relationship between the Mediterranean and the oceans, and what really comes to the fore, what I'm going to talk about today, is the Indian Ocean, because the Indian Ocean points in two directions. It points up either the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf towards the Middle East and ultimately Europe, and in the other direction, through the Malacca Straits into the South China Sea, you have links tying the Indies, I'll use the broad term, to China, and sometimes indeed the volume of trade from Southeast Asia towards China was much greater than the volume of trade towards the Middle East and Europe. But one really has to understand that this was an area which was constantly, without really any serious breaks, being traversed by merchants, certainly from the Greco-Roman period. And really, I think we can go even further back in time than that, which I will try to do in my lecture. So that the Indian Ocean really comes to the fore as the great highway linking not just the two ends of the Indian Ocean, but areas far beyond the Indian Ocean. So what I'm trying to describe is a series of networks that ultimately stretch all the way from Japan to Spain, though people in Spain for many centuries knew virtually nothing about Japan and vice versa. But there were these links. There were goods passing most of the way, at any rate, down, up and down these trade routes.
Now, in the course of the 20th century, there have been periodic movements of thought favouring protectionism, and then movements of thought favouring free trade, come and go. And occasionally there have been attempts at proving that the Silk Route, for example, was a precursor of that free trade movement, facilitating ideas and movement of ideas and thoughts and peoples as well as of goods. But I might be right, perhaps, in thinking that you don't think the Silk Route is really as important as the oceanic voyages of the traders.
I think, in fact, it's quite easy to prove that the volume of goods that was passing by sea from, for instance, China to, for instance, Egypt in the Middle Ages was quite massive. I mean, in Cairo, in old Cairo, Fustat, a sort of suburb of Cairo nowadays, where the foreign merchants and the Jewish and Coptic merchants tended to live, they have discovered 700,000 pieces of Chinese porcelain from the Middle Ages. I mean, these are fragments, so no doubt several pieces make up one bowl.
700,000.
So the volume of this trade is absolutely staggering. And when you actually look also at the movement across the South China Sea itself, you've got people who seem to be accumulating wealth equivalent to, well, the currency was expressed in terms of cash, which are those little coins with holes in them. And the cash were put on strings, and we're told of revenues for the imperial treasury of sometimes a million strings a year, and even of merchants who had hundreds of thousands of strings tied away in their, however they banked them. I mean, that's an interesting question. I don't know what they did with them. So vast amounts of metal moving around in payment as well. It's an extraordinary story. And if you compare that to the Silk Road, which has undoubtedly sometimes been an important means of communication, particularly with what we now tend to call Eurasia, so those areas well inland, but at other times was cut off from China, or cut off from Europe as a result of political circumstances. So in the sort of 11th century, the Song Dynasty in China, which really controlled southern China, didn't have access to the areas in the north, which themselves gave access to the old Silk Route. So it comes and goes. It's always there, but it seems to me it doesn't compare in significance. It's become a great legend because, of course, there have been amazing finds along the Silk Route of caves full of Buddhist relics and paintings and things like this. But one shouldn't be deceived by that into thinking that that was the main means of communication.
And the nature of the relationship between governments, customs and duties, officers, raisers of revenue in various forms, and this trade. Are there certain continuous themes? We think of governments these days as being rather keen on trade, wanting to have more trade in order to raise revenue, of course. Can we trace a continuous history to that? The state as an enabler of trade or a frustrator of trade?
By and large, in the Indian Ocean, it's an enabler, facilitator of trade. And in some places, we actually have, in southern India, for instance, we have from the 9th century evidence that the kings of one petty kingdom really entrusted the collection of taxes, the management of trade, both to the west and to the east, so towards Indonesia as well as towards Aden and the Red Sea, to groups of merchants, to guilds of merchants, and the merchants going out to the west were actually foreigners, they weren't even the king's subjects. But the point was to encourage them, obviously, to use this place as a centre of business. So that sort of thing is quite typical. What is different, and I think really fascinating, is the way in which the Chinese emperors, who occasionally were sending ships into the Indian Ocean, but their attitude, by and large, with the exception of these Song emperors, their attitude is very often discouraging of trade. Trade they regard as something which actually undermines external trade, maritime trade, to them seems to undermine the exchange networks within China itself. What they're interested in instead is tribute, exchanges of tribute for gifts. So gifts coming out of the imperial palace and very, very considerable quantities of goods, which are of course then destined for the emperor, the courtiers, who are allowed to do a little bit of trading on the side if they go on the expedition. And it's a very different sort of approach to trade, which sometimes led to the contraction of Chinese trade in the South China Sea. And beyond that, sometimes also led to the disappearance of Chinese-owned shipping. So this gave a tremendous opportunity to the people that we don't tend to think about. We don't tend to think much about the Tamils or the Malays, but these were the people who really managed a lot of these trade routes in the Indian Ocean and then up into the South China Sea, not the Chinese themselves.
So that would be an example of highly hierarchical, or an aspiration anyway, society, seeing trade as being disruptive of the established order of things. And
yes,
not viewing possible riches, really, with any
great
alacrity.
It can be corrupting, of course, as the ancient Romans also would sometimes argue that it drained money out of the empire. It led to wasteful expenditure by the nobility, that sort of thing. You certainly see that attitude. And particular concern, actually, about the drainage of bullion out of particular territories.
Yes, a feature of more enclosed societies. As an example of the more protectionist economics in the 19th century, and then the emergence of similar patterns of thought in the 17th century as well. David Abernathy, thank you so very much indeed.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.